Not only do you have to move from point A to B in life, but point A is often a very difficult place to be because we're fragile and bounded and mortal and limited, and because we know that. And so one of the implications of that, as many great religious traditions are at pains to illustrate or demonstrate or proclaim, is that life is essentially suffering. And I believe that to be a fundamental truth. But perhaps not the most fundamental truth, because I think the most fundamental truth is that despite the fact that life is suffering, people can transcend that. And partly the way they transcend that is by pursuing things of value. And so that if there is no value proposition at hand, then you have no meaning to justify the difficult conditions of your life. And that's brutally difficult for people. You know, Nietzsche said, he who has a why can bear any how. And you see, and I've certainly seen this as a clinical practitioner, that people who have no purpose in their life are embittered by the difficulties of their life. And they become first bitter, and then resentful, and then revengeful, and then cruel. And there's plenty of places to go past cruel. That's just where you start if you're really on a downhill path.
When engaging in sacrifice, our forefathers began to act out what would be considered a proposition, if it were stated in words, that something better might be attained in the future by giving up something of value in the present. Recall, if you will, that the necessity for work is one of the curses placed by God upon Adam and his descendants in consequence of original sin. Adam's waking to the fundamental constraints of his being, his vulnerability, his eventual death, is equivalent to his discovery of the future. The future, that's where you go to die, hopefully, not too soon. Your demise might be staved off through work, through the sacrifice of the now to gain benefit later. It is for this reason, among others no doubt, that the concept of sacrifice is introduced in the biblical chapter immediately following the drama of the fall. There is little difference between sacrifice and work. They are also both uniquely human. Sometimes animals act as if they are working, but they are really only following the dictates of their nature. Beavers build dams. They do so because they are beavers, and beavers build dams. They don't think, yeah, but I'd rather be on a beach in Mexico with my girlfriend while they're doing it. Prosaically, such sacrifice, work, is the delay of gratification, but that's a very mundane phrase to describe something of such profound significance. The discovery that gratification could be delayed was simultaneously the discovery of time, and with it, causality, at least the causal force of voluntary human action. Long ago, in the dim mists of time, we began to realize that reality was structured as if it could be bargained with. We learned that behaving properly now, in the present, regulating our impulses, considering the plight of others, could bring rewards in the future, in a time and place that did not yet exist. We began to inhibit, control, and organize our immediate impulses so that we could stop interfering with other people and our future selves. Doing so was indistinguishable from organizing society. The discovery of the causal relationship between our efforts today and the quality of tomorrow motivated the social contract, the organization that enables today's work to be stored, reliably mostly in the form of promises from others. Understanding is often acted out before it can be articulated, just as a child acts out what it means to be mother or father before being able to give a spoken account of what those roles mean. The act of making a ritual sacrifice to God was an early and sophisticated enactment of the idea of the usefulness of delay. There is a long conceptual journey between merely feasting hungrily and learning to set aside some extra meat, smoked by the fire, for the end of the day, or for someone who isn't present. It takes a long time to learn to keep anything later for yourself or to share it with someone else, and those are very much the same thing as. In the former case, you are sharing with your future self. It is much easier and far more likely to selfishly and immediately wolf down everything in sight. There are similar long journeys between every leap in sophistication with regard to delay and its conceptualization. Short-term sharing, storing away for the future, representation of that storage in the form of records and, later, in the form of currency, and ultimately the saving of money in a bank or other social institution, some conceptualizations had to serve as intermediaries, or the full range of our practices and ideas surrounding sacrifice and work and their representation could have never emerged. Our ancestors acted out a drama, a fiction. They personified the force that governs fate as a spirit that can be bargained with, traded with as if it were another human being. And the amazing thing is that it worked. This was in part because the future is largely composed of other human beings, often precisely those who have watched and evaluated and appraised the tiniest details of your past behavior. It's not very far from that to God sitting above on high, tracking your every move and writing it down for further reference in a big book. Here's a productive symbolic idea. The future is a judgmental father. That's a good start. But two additional archetypal foundational questions arose because of the discovery of sacrifice, of work. Both have to do with the ultimate extension of the logic of work, which is sacrifice now to gain later. First question, what must be sacrificed? Small sacrifices may be sufficient to solve small, singular problems, but it is possible that larger, more comprehensive sacrifices might solve an array of large and complex problems all at the same time. That's harder, but it might be better. Adapting to the necessary discipline of medical school will, for example, fatally interfere with the licentious lifestyle of a hardcore undergraduate party animal. Giving that up is a sacrifice. But a physician can, to paraphrase George W., really put food on his family. That's a lot of trouble to dispense with over a very long period of time. So sacrifices are necessary to improve the future, and larger sacrifices can be better. Second question, set of related questions, really. We've already established the basic principle. Sacrifice will improve the future, but a principle, once established, has to be fleshed out. Its full extension or significance has to be understood. What is implied by the idea that sacrifice will improve the future in the most extreme and final of cases? Where does that basic principle find its limits? We must ask, to begin, what would be the largest, most effective, most pleasing of all possible sacrifices? And then how good might the best possible future be if the most effective sacrifice could be made? The biblical story of Cain and Abel, Adam and Eve's sons, immediately follows the story of the expulsion from paradise. Cain and Abel are really the first humans, since their parents were made directly by God and not born in the standard manner. Cain and Abel live in history, not in Eden. They must work. They must make sacrifices to please God, and they do so with altar and proper ritual. But things get complicated. Abel's offerings please God, but Cain's do not. Abel is rewarded many times over, but Cain is not. It's not precisely clear why, although the text strongly hints that Cain's heart is just not in it. Maybe the quality of what Cain put forward was low. Maybe his spirit was begrudging. Or maybe God was vexed for some secret reasons of his own. And all of this is realistic, including the text's vagueness of explanation. Not all sacrifices are of equal quality. Furthermore, it often appears that sacrifices of apparently high quality are not rewarded with a better future, and it's not clear why. Why isn't God happy? What would have to change to make him so? Those are difficult questions, and everyone asks them all the time, even if they don't notice. Asking such questions is indistinguishable from thinking. The realization that pleasure could be usefully forestalled dawned on us with great difficulty. It runs absolutely contrary to our ancient fundamental animal instincts, which demand immediate satisfaction, particularly under conditions of deprivation, which are both inevitable and commonplace. And to complicate the matter, such delay only becomes useful when civilization has stabilized itself enough to guarantee the existence of the delayed reward in the future. If everything you save will be destroyed, or worse, stolen, there is no point in saving. It is for this reason that a wolf will down 20 pounds of raw meat in a single meal. He isn't thinking, man, I hate it when I binge. I should save some of this for next week. So how was it that those two impossible and necessarily simultaneous accomplishments, delay and the stabilization of society into the future, could possibly have manifested themselves? Here is a developmental progression. From animal to human. It's wrong, no doubt, in the details. but it's sufficiently correct for our purposes in theme. First, there is excess food, large carcasses, mammoths, or other massive herbivores might provide that. We ate a lot of mammoths, maybe all of them, after a kill. With a large animal, there is some left for later. That's accidental at first, but eventually, the utility of for later starts to be appreciated. Some provisional notion of sacrifice develops at the same time. If I leave some, even if I want it now, I won't have to be hungry later. That provisional notion develops to the next level. If I leave some for later, I won't have to go hungry, and neither will those I care for. And then to the next, I can't possibly eat all of this mammoth, but I can't store the rest for too long, either. Maybe I should feed some to other people. Maybe they'll remember and feed me some of their mammoth, when they have some and I have none. Then I'll get some mammoth now, and some mammoth later. That's a good deal. And maybe those I'm sharing with will come to trust me more generally. Maybe then we could trade forever. In such a manner, mammoth becomes future mammoth, and future mammoth becomes personal reputation. That's the emergence of the social contract. To share does not mean to give away something you value and get nothing back. That is instead only what every child who refuses to share fears it means. To share means properly to initiate the process of trade. A child who can't share, who can't trade, can't have any friends because having friends is a form of trade. Benjamin Franklin once suggested that a newcomer to a neighborhood ask a new neighbor to do him or her a favor, citing an old maxim. He that has once done you a kindness will be more ready to do you another than he whom you yourself have obliged. In Franklin's opinion, asking someone for something, not too extreme, obviously, was the most useful and immediate invitation to social interaction. Such asking on the part of the newcomer provided the neighbor with an opportunity to show him or herself as a good person at the first encounter. It also meant that the latter could now ask the former for a favor in return because of the debt incurred, increasingly their mutual familiarity and trust. In that manner, both parties could overcome their natural hesitancy and mutual fear of the stranger. It is better to have something than nothing. It's better yet to share generously the something you have. It's even better than that, however, to become widely known for generous sharing. That's something that lasts. That's something that's reliable. And at this point of abstraction, we can observe how the groundwork for the conceptions reliable, honest, and generous has been laid. The basis for an articulated morality has been put in place. The productive, truthful sharer is the prototype for the good citizen and the good man. We can see in this manner how from the simple notion that leftovers are a good idea, the highest moral principles might emerge. It's as if something like the following happened as humanity developed. First were the endless tens or hundreds of thousands of years prior to the emergence of written history and drama. During this time, the twin practices of delay and exchange began to emerge, slowly and painfully. Then they became represented in metaphorical abstraction as rituals and tales of sacrifice, told in a manner such as this. It's as if there is a powerful figure in the sky who sees all and is judging you. Giving up something you value seems to make him happy. And you want to make him happy, because all hell breaks loose if you don't. So practice sacrificing and sharing until you become expert at it, and things will go well for you. No one said any of this, at least not so plainly and directly. But it was implicit in the practice, and then in the stories. Action came first, as it had to, as the animals we once were could act, but could not think. Implicit, unrecognized value came first, as the actions that preceded thought embodied value, but did not make that value explicit. People watched the successful succeed, and the unsuccessful fail for thousands and thousands of years. We thought it over and drew a conclusion. The successful among us delay gratification. The successful among us bargain with the future. A great idea begins to emerge, taking ever more clearly articulated form in ever more clearly articulated stories. What's the difference between the successful and the unsuccessful? The successful sacrifice. Things get better as the successful practice their sacrifices. The questions become increasingly precise and simultaneously broader. What is the greatest possible sacrifice for the greatest possible good? And the answers become increasingly deeper and profound. The God of Western tradition, like so many gods, requires sacrifice. We have already examined why, but sometimes he goes even further. He demands not only sacrifice, but the sacrifice of precisely what is loved best. This is most starkly portrayed and most confusingly evident in the story of Abraham and Isaac. Abraham, beloved of God, long wanted a son, and God promised him exactly that. After many delays and under the apparently impossible conditions of old age and a long barren wife, but not so long afterward, when the miraculously born Isaac is still a child, God turns around and, in unreasonable and apparently barbaric fashion, demands that his faithful servant offer his son as a sacrifice. The story ends happily. God sends an angel to stay Abraham's obedient hand and accepts a ram in Isaac's stead. That's a good thing, but it doesn't really address the issue at hand. Why is God's going further necessary? Why does life impose such demands? We'll start our analysis with a truism, stark, self-evident, and understated. Sometimes things do not go well. That seems to have much to do with the terrible nature of the world, with its plagues and famines and tyrannies and betrayals. But here's the rub. Sometimes, when things are not going well, it's not the world that's the cause. The cause is instead that which is currently most valued subjectively and personally. Why? Because the world is revealed to an indeterminate degree through the template of your values. If the world you are seeing is not the world you want, therefore, it's time to examine your values. It's time to rid yourself of your current presuppositions. It's time to let go. It might even be time to sacrifice what you love best so that you can become who you might become instead of staying who you are.
Tell your kid, here's an impossible thing. Why don't you go out and fail? You say, here's something worth going after. Here's a step you could take that would push you beyond where you are, but that you also have a reasonably high probability of succeeding at. Mm-hmm. Right? They call that
within a time frame.
Some time frame. That's the other thing. You have to parameterize it with regards to time frame. That's right. And that puts you in the zone of proximal development. And that's a concept that was generated by a guy named Vygotsky. He was a Russian developmental psychologist and a smart one. It's where the idea of the zone comes from, to be in the zone. Yes. And when you're in the zone, you're expanding your skills in a manner that's intrinsically rewarding because you're succeeding. And so you want to set, if you're good to yourself, you think, okay, I need to set a goal, but I need to set a goal that someone as stupid and useless as me could probably attain if they put some effort into it.
Right.
And then you've got it perfectly, because it's not so high that it's grandiose or impossible that you fail necessarily and then justify your bitterness. It's like, well, I could do well, because that happens to people.
Happens all the time.
Yeah, it's like,
I see this all the time.
You know, yes, exactly. Well, I set a goal and I didn't attain it, so I'm not going to set any more goals.
Right.
It's like, no, you set a goal that was inappropriate
for the time frame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's right. You didn't calibrate it properly,
yeah.
And you're playing a trick on yourself because you wanted to fail so that you could justify not having to try.
And being a victim,
Which isn't helpful. You're still going to be a victim. It's like there's no way out of that, man.
Yeah.
So, you know, because life is a challenge that in some sense can't be surmounted. So there's no way out of your problem, but there are certainly proper ways of dealing with it.
Yeah.
There's an old and possibly apocryphal story about how to catch a monkey that illustrates this set of ideas very well. First, you must find a large, narrow-necked jar, just barely wide enough in diameter at the top for a monkey to put its hand inside. Then you must fill the jar partway with rocks, so it is too heavy for a monkey to carry. Then you must scatter some treats, attractive to monkeys, near the jar to attract one, and put some more inside the jar. A monkey will come along, reach into the narrow opening, and grab while the grabbing's good. But now he won't be able to extract his fist, now full of treats, from the too narrow opening of the jar. Not without unclenching his hand, not without relinquishing what he already has. And that's just what he won't do. The monkey catcher can just walk over to the jar and pick up the monkey. The animal will not sacrifice the part to preserve the whole. Something valuable given up ensures future prosperity. something valuable sacrificed pleases the Lord, what is most valuable and best sacrificed, or what is at least emblematic of that, a choice cut of meat, the best animal in a flock, a most valued possession, what's above even that, something intensely personal and painful to give up. That's symbolized, perhaps, in God's insistence on circumcision as part of Abraham's sacrificial routine, where the part is offered symbolically to redeem the whole. What's beyond that? What pertains more closely to the whole person rather than the part? What constitutes the ultimate sacrifice for the gain of the ultimate prize? It's a close race between child and self. The sacrifice of the mother offering her child to the world is exemplified profoundly by Michelangelo's great sculpture, the Pietà. Michelangelo crafted Mary contemplating her son crucified and ruined. It's her fault. It was through her that he entered the world and its great drama of being. Is it right to bring a baby into this terrible world? Every woman asks herself that question. Some say no, and they have their reasons. Mary answers yes, voluntarily, knowing full well what's to come, as do all mothers if they allow themselves to see. It's an act of supreme courage when undertaken voluntarily. In turn, Mary's son, Christ, offers himself to God and the world to betrayal, torture, and death, to the very point of despair on the cross, where he cries out those terrible words, "My God, why hast thou forsaken me?" Matthew 27:46. That is the archetypal story of the man who gives his all for the sake of the better, who offers up his life for the advancement of being, who allows God's will to become manifest fully within the confines of a single mortal life. That is the model for the honorable man. In Christ's case, however, as he sacrifices himself, God, his Father, is simultaneously sacrificing his Son. It is for this reason that the Christian sacrificial drama of Son and Self is archetypal. It's a story at the limit, where nothing more extreme, nothing greater, can be imagined. That's the very definition of archetypal. That's the core of what constitutes religious. Pain and suffering define the world. Of that, there can be no doubt. Sacrifice can hold pain and suffering in abeyance to a greater or lesser degree, and greater sacrifices can do that more effectively than lesser. Of that, there can be no doubt. Everyone holds this knowledge in their soul. Thus, the person who wishes to alleviate suffering, who wishes to rectify the flaws in being, who wants to bring about the best of all possible futures, who wants to create heaven on earth, will make the greatest of sacrifices of self and child, of everything that is loved, to live a life aimed at the good. He will forego expediency. He will pursue the path of ultimate meaning. And he will in that manner bring salvation to the ever desperate world. But is such a thing even possible? Is this simply not asking too much of the individual? It's all well and good for Christ. It might be objected, but he was the veritable Son of God. But we do have other examples, some much less mythologized and archetypal. Consider, for example, the case of Socrates, the ancient Greek philosopher. After a lifetime of seeking the truth and educating his countrymen, Socrates faced a trial for crimes against the city, state of Athens, his hometown. His accusers provided him with plenty of opportunity to simply leave and avoid the trouble. But the great sage had already considered and rejected this course of action. His companion Hermogenes observed him at this time discussing any and every subject other than his trial, and asked him why he appeared so unconcerned. Socrates first answered that he had been preparing his whole life to defend himself, but then said something more mysterious and significant. When he attempted specifically to consider strategies that would produce acquittal by fair means or foul, or even when merely considering his potential actions at the trial, he found himself interrupted by his divine sign, his internal spirit, voice, or demon. Socrates discussed this voice at the trial itself. He said that one of the factors distinguishing him from other men was his absolute willingness to listen to its warnings, to stop speaking and cease acting when it objected. The gods themselves had deemed him wise above other men, not least for this reason. According to the Delphic Oracle herself, held to be a reliable judge of such things, because his ever reliable internal voice objected to fleeing, or even to defending himself, Socrates radically altered his view of the significance of his trial. He began to consider that it might be a blessing rather than a curse. He told Hermogenes of his realization that the spirit to whom he had always listened might be offering him a way out of life in a manner easiest but also the least irksome to one's friends, with sound body and a spirit capable of showing kindliness and absent the throes of illness and vexations of extreme old age. Socrates' decision to accept his fate allowed him to put away mortal terror in the face of death itself, prior to and during the trial, after the sentence was handed down, and even later, during his execution. He saw that his life had been so rich and full that he could let it go gracefully. He was given the opportunity to put his affairs in order. He saw that he could escape the terrible slow degeneration of the advancing years. He came to understand all that was happening to him as a gift from the gods. He was not, therefore, required to defend himself against his accusers, at least not with the aim of pronouncing his innocence and escaping his fate. Instead, he turned the tables, addressing his judges in a manner that makes the reader understand precisely why the town council wanted this man dead. Then he took his poison, like a man. Socrates rejected expediency and the necessity for manipulation that accompanied it. He chose instead, under the direst of conditions, to maintain his pursuit of the meaningful and the true. 2,500 years later, we remember his decision and take comfort from it. What can we learn from this? If you cease to utter falsehoods and live according to the dictates of your conscience, you can maintain your nobility even when facing the ultimate threat. If you abide truthfully and courageously by the highest of ideals, you will be provided with more security and strength than will be offered by any short-sighted concentration on your own safety. If you live properly, fully, you can discover meaning so profound that it protects you even from the fear of death. Could all that possibly be true?
We're built for struggle, us human beings. You're not after the bubbles of bliss that Dostoevsky described in Notes from Underground. We're built to contend with the world. We're built to contend with reality. You want a challenge, and the best way that you can take on a challenge, because a challenge fortifies you, so you don't want to be secure, you want to be strong, and you get strong by taking on optimal challenges. And so you lay out your destiny in the world, and you take the slings and arrows of fate, and you make yourself stronger while you're doing so, and you might fail, and fortune might do you in, but it's your best bet. And, you know, people have extracted unbelievable successes out of catastrophic failures. And I'm not saying that in a naive way. I know perfectly well what happens to people. You know, you're doing fine in life and then you get cancer. And then 6 months later, you're dead. And all the heroism in the world isn't going to save you at that point. But that's not the point. That's not the point. Life is bounded by mortality. But that doesn't mean that you don't get out there and contend, and you develop by contending, and you minimize the net amount of suffering in the world. And that's something, man. That's something to do.